Yeah.
In general, are Minpaku or short-term stay properties supposed to be always a bit cheaper than hotels, or does it run the gamut kind of thing?
Real. I mean, I don't sell myself as a cheap place to stay. I sell because they're not, yes, they're both got places to sleep, right? But they are different experiences. And there's nothing wrong with it. Like, not everyone wants to stay in a short-term rental. It depends on what their travel plans are. And I don't see myself as competing with a hotel because I offer value that a hotel can't. But it really does depend on the individual user, the individual customer, based on what they're wanting to buy. My product, I'm really trying to be very clear about my product. And my product isn't a hotel substitution. It's got, it will give you a lot more. But if you're not interested in learning about Japanese culture or learning what it's like to live in a suburb, if you've just got bucket list items to tick off, either for work or for whatever reason, then staying in a hotel is just is a perfectly valid option as well. So yeah, it's always a juggle, always a juggle.
Hi there, folks, and welcome or welcome back to Nippon Trading International's Japan Real Estate Podcast. I'm your host, Ziv Nakajima again, and this podcast is brought to you, among others, by Emil Gorgis of realestate.jp. He's a Tokyo real estate agent who specializes in serving international or mixed nationality families who are looking for the perfect family home. So Emil's an Australian. He's been living here in Japan for over 2 decades now. And for about half of that time, he's been buying, selling, and managing real estate properties in Tokyo on behalf of his own family and a great many happy clients. And he also acts as a mortgage broker on behalf of his clients. So he's got dedicated loan officers in many of the Japanese mega banks. And if you're a regular listener of the podcast, you probably already know him from our JREP, the Japan Real Estate Experts panel sessions, which means that you're already aware of the fact that the man is an absolute fountain of wisdom on all things related to real estate in Japan, and in particular to family homes, the greater Tokyo metropolitan area, and mortgages. And most importantly, he's incredibly generous with his time and advice, which he's more than happy to provide at no cost or commitment to anyone asking. So if you've been thinking about buying your home in Tokyo, but you've been sitting on the fence for a while, or you just want to have a chat in English with a real expert, drop him a line on sales@realestate.jp. Hit him up today and start exploring your options. All right, so right before we get into today's episode, quick reminder that we're very grateful and appreciative of your positive reviews on the Apple Store and Spotify. Please keep those coming. Oh, and also, since one of the recent reviewers was wondering how they could show their appreciation for everything that we share here, I just wanted to point out once again that, well, first of all, those reviews are a fantastic way to show your appreciation since they help more people find us. But also, if you're really feeling this podcast is bringing you some value, saving you from costly mistakes, or otherwise financially benefiting you as well, I've set up a page on Buy Me a Coffee. That's buymeacoffee.com/Zmagen, my first initial and the last part of my last name. So buymeacoffee.com/Zmagen. Don't feel obliged to, by any means. I love making this podcast, and hearing that it brings value to you is definitely good enough for me. But you do have the option to make a small donation, buy me a virtual coffee, or better yet, a shot of some premium whiskey or another. Your tokens of gratitude are always appreciated. So now, for today's episode, this is another JREP session with Tracy Northcott, Emil Gorgis, and myself in attendance this time. And Tracy took the stage mostly this time around as we spoke about all things related to short-term and monthly rentals. So the seasonal nature of those types of rentals, pricing strategies, and how to find the balance between profitability and market value, comparisons with hotel prices, when are those in order, and also a lot about due diligence, licensing, and how it all works. Then beyond licensing, we also talked about how to ensure smooth sailing once your hospitality properties are operational. And then we segue into another conversation about when do monthly rentals, when might those be a better fit? So dealing with possible complications of monthly rentals, especially when done in a condominium, which isn't always possible. And of course, how to search for and purchase the right property for this purpose. So working with agents, proxies like ourselves, short-term stay or monthly rentals management companies. And then finally, a bit of a riff, or maybe a riff and a bit of a rant on unicorn hunters. You know who you are. So really nice deep dive into all things related to more creative rental / hospitality properties. Hope you enjoy our little chat, and I'll see you again on the other side.
All right, the Japan Real Estate Experts panel is back in session. It's been a while. How have you all been?
It is cherry blossom season. So this is our peak season. If you've ever walked around the streets of Tokyo, you will see just how popular we are right now. It's mad.
Now it's nice and warm too. It jumped by about 20 degrees in about a week, right?
Well, it snowed last week, and now it's like, and now it's, you know, 20 degrees.
It's 24 degrees in Tokyo. I had a client who just flew in yesterday, the 25th, is that yesterday? Yeah, yesterday morning. And he was at the airport. I'm not sure if it's Narita or Haneda, but he said the line for taxis is like 40 deep, full of Americans and Chinese. I know when I used to do Airbnb, and Tracy, you were just saying a second ago how this is like bonkers season for you. The last 2 weeks of March, first 2 weeks of April, this 4 week period is the peak travel tourism period in the whole Japan. Yep. Yeah, it is so busy.
Mm. Yep. And I can't list places fast enough. I listed a new place last week, which it's just stunning. It's like this 4-bedroom, mid-century modern, very glam house. I had 3 million yen's worth of bookings in 3 weeks. It's crazy. It's crazy times. So
you can probably charge more now too, right? I was booking the hotel for the summit that we got coming up in a couple of weeks, and there was not a room to be found for less than like 30,000 yen a night.
Yes, and absolutely. And I've got to be mindful when I talk on podcasts and things about pricing, because obviously there's two parts to the coin. There's like me as the business owner wanting to obviously maximize my profits and maximize the, the returns for the owners that I work with, and also for my business, because, you know, we all love us some money. But at the same time, I've got to be mindful that I want people to see that what I'm offering is market value and it's not price gouging. And so I'm always wary about which audience I'm speaking to, about, you know, making sure that people don't think, oh, you know, she's just doing a money grab or whatever. And I guess even me just voicing that shows you that I really do care about the value. But yeah, the prices are really high, and market value is really high.
Ever come into your, like, factoring the prices, that, like, do you compare what Airbnb hosts, obviously you're comparing what other hosts are charging, but do you also compare yourself to hotel prices? Are you supposed to be lower?
I use dynamic pricing, so that takes the emotion out of it. It takes the emotion out of it, which means that I put in what type of property that I've got and the area, and then that then scrapes all the hotel data and it scrapes all of the other Airbnb and booking.com and all of it. And then it puts it through the algorithm and then it actually gives you what the market price is for your property for those dates.
And it does check on the hotel pricing as well.
Does check on the hotel prices as well. And so then I can then do, you know, and then I bring my human eyes in with my local knowledge and local experience. And also with some properties, it is just short term, and other properties I'm monthly. So I'm able to then tweak based on what I feel is a fair price for the value. I probably am on the dynamic pricing keeps telling me I should be higher and higher and higher. But the human side of me does tend to, you know, to bring it back a little bit, mainly because I want to get booked, right? And I don't want to price myself out of the market. So it's always a tug of war, really.
In general, are minpaku or short-term stay properties supposed to be always a bit cheaper than hotels, or does it run the gamut kind of thing?
I don't sell myself as a cheap place to stay. I sell because they're not, yes, they've both got places to sleep, right? But they are different experiences, and there's nothing wrong with it. Like, not everyone wants to stay in a short-term rental. It depends on what their travel plans are. And I don't see myself as competing with a hotel because I offer value that a hotel can't. But it really does depend on the individual user, the individual customer, based on what they're wanting to buy. My product, I'm really trying to be very clear about my product. And my product isn't a hotel substitution. It's got, it will give you a lot more. But if you're not interested in learning about Japanese culture or learning what it's like to live in a suburb, if you've just got bucket list items to tick off, either for work or for whatever reason, then staying in a hotel is a perfectly valid option as well. So, yeah, it's always a juggle, always a juggle.
I found like when I had a dozen Airbnb properties, I was, listing. There's the small studio apartments, which are just a one room studio for two people. They compete with a hotel room, essentially.
Yeah, exactly. I don't do that. I don't play in that space.
Yeah, I used to, and I got rid of those. And then you have the two bedroom, three bedroom, or full house type setup. And that is really hard to compare for a hotel. So a
Unless it's
hotel,
like the honeymoon suite at the Hilton or something, but yeah.
exactly. So it changes dramatically because now the suite rooms at hotels are 100,000 yen, 200,000 yen plus per night. And it's a different kind of clientele than, hey, we have a Thai family of three generations, 10 people want to stay in a house. They're not going to buy these suite rooms at the Grand Hyatt with
No.
three bedroom, like, or two bedroom monster places. So it doesn't play in the same space. People want an accommodation that has the kitchen where they can do their own shopping and cook themselves, right? In order to manage costs. Maybe they've got young kids with them. The moment you do hotels, there's limits on the bedding, right? Maximum of four people per room. I've got three kids. Trying to find a hotel that will allow for five people on a booking is actually quite tough. And then you have to go to these suite rooms, which all of a sudden, instead of being, 15, 20, 30,000 yen a night, is like 80 plus thousand yen a night because of little baby, right? That will just sleep, invisibly in between you anyway. So it's hard to compare. Do you charge more than hotels or not? I think a three bedroom house doesn't have a comparable hotel equivalent. If you want the same 100 square meter suite room in a hotel with kitchen and everything, that's going to be priced way above what your three bedroom house would be
Well, I
priced at.
mean, there's like really fancy machias in Kyoto and stuff that will house an entire family, but they don't cost less than a hotel suite, usually more.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah, it depends on what you're buying, right? So,
Yeah, it's hard to find a comparable once you go beyond the standard. Like Airbnb used to be, a one room apart, like just a 20 square meter little room with a bed and a kitchenette. That's comparable to traditional hotel rooms that we know. But once you go to these higher ones that are more catered for families, it's hard to compare to find comparable hotels. So pricing is different. But on the note, Tracy, I think just before we started, we said one issue is rules and regulations about Airbnb and registering for Airbnb. Maybe talk about that because I also get lots of inquiries for people saying, I want a place that is okay for Airbnb and short-term stay. And I have to shoot them down quite often. But why don't you go
Oh man,
about
I've got script. Tracy, if you want, I've got scripts upon scripts that I automatically send to people when they bring up the word Airbnb by default.
Oh,
Hey, Max.
it's Max,
Hello.
my son, who's just walking.
Is
Where
he coming to the summit? Is he gonna be our guy under the table again?
I don't know. Are you Max coming to the summit on the 11th and 12th, like 12th and 13th of April? So. Yes. So let me just unblur my background. So hello,
Hey, Max.
we're live on a podcast, so we're live on
Well,
YouTube.
you're
So
kind of famous. We got photos of you under the table at the not the last summit, the one before.
yeah.
Yeah,
There we go. No, but it's school holiday, so I've got him working in the office. Like, Child labor. Child labor. Exactly. Exactly.
We're starting on that now too. Ori can officially get a Baito now because he's just going into high school. So he's like, "All right, man, study up on Excel and Word Office documents and whatever, and let's get you researching shit."
Yeah, I've got him making up. So I've got him making up amenity packs. So with the so there was a not the you know there was a bad earthquake in Notor a year ago.
Yeah, one of our staffers was there. She's still there, but they were living in the community center for a while.
So what I did was there was a company over there that was completely like they had a like a ryokan, and it was completely devastated. And I thought, well, I can give you money, or I can. They also make these handmade soaps, yuzu soaps, or I can buy up your stock of yuzu soaps. So that's what I did. I bought up their stock of yuzu soaps, and then we're putting them into nice little packages with a note on it to say, "If you, here is a present for you." It was part of our fundraising to help our friends over in Noto. If we bought it, it's for you. If you want to buy more, please contact the other companies directly. So. Yes.
Yeah, sorry. So yeah, questions about Airbnb that I have no idea about licensing.
So yeah, so that's the issue is that you know you've got to do your due diligence before you actually buy anything. That's the biggest issue. So you before you have it's and it's only a 5 minute phone call. I get and you don't want to buy something and then find out later that you can't get it listed or you can't get it licensed because there is no marketplace for monthly rentals. Yes, you could do a monthly rental situation, but it's really hard to find monthly rental customers because there's no, you know, as one house, it's really hard. You're gonna have to spend a lot of time going out there looking for your guests. Yeah, so that's what I tell people. I get a lot of people every week going, "Oh, I want to do what you're doing." It's like, okay, but this is the steps
Here's
to
what's
go
involved.
ahead. This is what you have to do. It's there's a lot of hoops to jump through, and I think a lot of the people that I speak to, I talk them out of it a little bit because as well, it's not a passive job. It's not a passive thing to do, and you've got to like people, and you've got to like taking care of people as much as you like earning the money because. It, you know, yes, you can make a lot of money, but it is, you know, like if you're doing long-term rental, like that's really hands off. Short-term rentals, it's not just putting in a couple of coffee cups and curtains on the windows. It's it is
Relationships and
hospitality.
getting
It's
cozy with the neighbors and the local shop owners like you do. We had a guy
absolutely.
contact us who's like he's an architect and he designs he virtually imports like stuff entire houses from Japan and rebuilds them in California wherever he was at. And he's
Wow.
like, wow, okay, I want to buy one of these now in Japan and I want to run it as an Airbnb. And we started on the process, like he paid us in advance, like everybody does. And you know, first property we ran into, the listing agent said, okay, well, Minpaku, the local community is not really friendly to Minpaku. Like, they're not going to be okay with it. So we recommend that. And the guy's like, what? You know what? Never mind. Don't worry about it. Never asked for his money back, anything, just disappeared. He was just so upset that there's stuff involved in Japan that he didn't think. And I saw people on Facebook as well, like they're posting the Japan Real Estate group, and one of them was asking about it, and somebody replied, "Well, yes, but you need to check with the neighbors, and you need to make sure the law." Well, why? If I'm legally allowed to do it, why wouldn't I? You know? It's not. It's a brain twister for people coming in, especially from Western countries, I feel. Now, if you've attended any of our recent JREP Summit events in Tokyo or online, you've probably heard our sponsor, Robert Miller from Innovatius.com. He's been in Webdiz Solutions here in Japan for the past 25 years, and he's also an active investor in Japanese real estate property, as well as global online property, which is his specialty and what his company, Innovatius, is all about. They offer a full suite of website services for entrepreneurs and small business owners, including all aspects of web design and management, backup and updates, content formatting and editing, proactive maintenance and error fixing, you name it, with a strong focus on SEO excellence, which is what gets you those hardcore top-of-the-list search engine rankings. But there is a difference. Innovatius works off a simple, all-inclusive monthly subscription model,
as opposed to the typical outdated and confusing project model. So you never have to wonder how much any request for any work to be done on your website might cost. It's always $497 per month. And if that's not enough, if you've mentioned you've heard of their services on the Japan Real Estate Podcast, you'll also get 10% off this monthly price for life. Also, and equally important, if not more, you can try out Innovatius for just 1 month, then switch them off, on again later if you want, and so forth. There are no minimum subscription terms. Now, if you're a small business owner, managing and growing a website is super distracting and time-consuming, right? That's exactly where Innovatius comes in. Robert's team takes care of all of that for you so that you can focus on what you do best. So feel free to email Rob on robert@innovatius.com, and his team will conduct a full SEO and website audit on your site, reveal anything that you should address to increase your website's appeal, and provide you with an easy-to-read detailed report with your own branding so that you can make some informed decisions on your online strategy and watch your business grow as you implement it. So once more, robert@innovatius.com. Drop him a line and get your website reviewed today.
Yeah, because you can't actually just do whatever you want to. I mean, and that's pretty much the same with anything, any business. You can't just come in and go, well, it's my business, I'm allowed to do what I'm like, my rights. It's like, that doesn't get you very far here. You've got to learn what the game is.
You're not gonna enjoy the fruits of that particularly.
No, it's, and you're always gonna be pushing up, like, you know, pushing against the tide, and that's hard.
I think there's definitely though a divide when you talk about big cities, in particular particularly Tokyo, and regional areas. So regional areas, yes, is a lot more community based. It's a house, and like, it's, you know, people know each other, right? And individually, there's only X amount. Like, but when you come into Tokyo, the density that you have here, there may be one or two people that are a handful that are like, oh no, we don't want it. But it's, you can kind of almost do what you can do within regulation. The opposite kind of holds true. It's very hard for people to stop you from doing what you're permitted to do, right? Whereas in
the big city, there's always going to be at least one or two people who are going to object, even if you're in an otherwise friendly neighborhood. There's always going to be that one, you know, grumpy old man around the corner who doesn't like you, right?
I know, and that's even if you're just living there.
Especially as a foreigner.
Yeah, so I found like, so actually there's kind of, Tracy, there's three very specific examples I can touch on right now, and two of them kind of include you that I'm working on, right? So that are Airbnb type related or not, right? So I think the big one is, if it's a mansion, if it's a condo, a unit in a building, just assume you cannot do Airbnb or the short-term stays.
Or even monthly in most cases, yeah.
In some, yes, but that's one. So that's a simple assumption. And then, if you want to do Airbnb short-term stays, I get lots of inquiries for people that want a holiday home and then want to rent it out on short-term stay when they're not here, then do that as a house. Get a house that you can do that, because a mansion is pretty much out of the question.
Or a small part of a building, if you've got the budget for that.
Or a whole building. You need to own the entire building. And be in control of the entire building. But that's why a house is the more common thing. So Tracy, on that note, I've sent you this before. There's a place in Minami Azabu, in Minamoku, which just falls about two doors into the area where Airbnb and hotels are permitted.
Are not permitted.
They are permitted. So that was, I went down to the ward office and did all the checks and stuff. Again, that's for a 210 million yen, so about 1.5 mil US. Again, initially it was a holiday house for this guy, but he's like, oh hey, well actually if it's also available for short-term rental, I'll do that. And this one, it's a three-story house, but it's concrete, and the way the staircase allows for it, should be okay for a hotel license as well. So a hotel allows 365 days a year booking, but so the first step will be, we'll apply for short term, like the Airbnb registration, and then do the slightly more complex hotel registration after that. But that's one that we're going to get you on there soon to handle the management of that. So that'll be one of your ones. That's a great three-story concrete house. Just near, like 10 minutes from Azabajuban station, like 6 minutes from Shirogane, Takanawa station.
Yeah, Minato-ku, you know, obviously each ku was different. Minato-ku with the Minpaku, regulations, is a challenge. Actually, I've got a call coming in, so I need to actually take this. So let.
I'll finish your sentence. Yeah, Minato-ku is quite strict in terms of the region and location. They've got a map, and it's not just the zoning. They've got even other sort of overlays of where it's permitted, where it's not. Most of it is not permitted. This one is in a slither where it is permitted. And literally, like 1.5 doors down on the map, is that's where it ends, and you're not permitted to do short-term stay or hotels. So this one really checks the box well for the client. That's one. Another one we did, we actually posted on social media. It's not usually the scope of properties that I do. I do mostly like 100 million yen and upwards. But one of Tracy's clients had an apartment. So this was actually a mansion that they're doing monthly rentals for, right? Not Airbnb, but like monthly. So people book from like 1 to 3 or 4 months at a time. And Tracy was handling that, but then her client, the owner of the property, was like, look, I'm not coming to Japan as frequently, let's sell it. And she's had it for a decade or so. We listed it. I put a post on social about it. It was like basically $150,000 US. And it had a nice view of Shinjuku. And we posted that, and we sold it in 3 weeks to another person who basically wants to do the same thing. He wants to come and stay for a few, he visits Japan a few times a year. So he wants a place there with easy access to Shinjuku and that part of town, which he can also put on short-term stay. It's not dead money. One of the issues he has is, you know, to buy a house in this area costs, you know, a lot more, like $500,000 US plus. But this one was an apartment for 150,000. It gets the same sort of functionality. It can be close to the city. And also it's not dead money. So that's basically turnkey. He just took it over. It's fully furnished, ready to go. And Tracy's just going to keep taking the ongoing management of that. So that was that's a very smooth one. We're settling for that in like 3 weeks' time, mid-April. And then, yeah, the other one we get, so I said there's three examples. One of it is that house we're buying, which is can be used as a hotel as well in Azabu, which is in a location that is permitted. But for most inquiries we get for Airbnb or short-term stay, it's like, no, you can't do it in central Tokyo in your budget. You can't find a house, etc., that will meet those requirements. Then we have this mansion that is done as a monthly mansion. That's a bit of a turnkey project. And then we have just majority of houses, people that want to use it as a holiday house. It's just, you know, if it's going to be a mansion, it's going to be not usable for Airbnb. If you want to use it for Airbnb and it's largely an investment, I suggest find a place that can be registered as a hotel, not just Airbnb short-term stay.
Yeah, so you can rent out throughout the year and they don't bother you as much, right?
Exactly. And also, it's, you know, if it's an investment, the return is like, you can bet double the amount of return, right? So you got to just spend right. The amount of work to register it for Minpaku versus a hotel is not too dissimilar, right? So buy the right place. I think invest in the right place that can be used as a hotel. But to be honest, for the most part, most inquiries I get, I tell people, no, I can't find a place for you that will just be built as a hotel, because their budgets are about, you know, 500,000 US. And I think in a central part of Tokyo, you're not going to find a place that can really do a good job as a hotel for that price range.
And I wanted to double click into something you said there. You mentioned that you've got a mansion room that's being set up as a monthly mansion, right? That's legally a Kumiai, owner union cannot prohibit you from doing that because it falls under normal rental legally. But if they don't like it, and sometimes they write clearly in the owner union, we don't allow monthly rentals, even though they're not legally allowed to ban it. They do give you a hard time, or they give your property manager a hard time, right? Like, no, you can't hang the key box outside the building, or they come knocking in the door and asking the guests if they're Airbnb-ing, or but how or do you even try to get around that when you're doing monthly projects?
Yeah, good question. So my response is, yeah, we don't get around that. I don't deal in those properties. I never do. If someone wants to do that, I'm like, yeah, no, sorry, I don't find properties that permit that. I don't find mansions that can try to do Airbnb.
That
That's not.
permit that you mean where the owner union is open to that. They're not against it.
Yeah, I tell people, look, in general, if you're looking for short-term stay, a place that can do it, find a house. Don't find a mansion. Get that out of
No,
there.
I mean specifically for monthly.
Yeah, or even for monthly, like, I'm not going to do the search for you. They may exist, but that's not the scope. That's not the work
Sorry,
that I do.
post delivery. Sorry.
Yep, well, everyone's gone.
Hi, Dozo.
We interrupt this broadcast to tell you about Tokyo Family Stays. They're a short-term rentals company in Tokyo, and they offer a home away from home experience, which is just perfect for remote working, quarantining, if that's still a thing, or if you just need somewhere quiet to get away from the world. They offer a variety of options for families, corporate relocations, or even if you're simply transitioning between homes in Tokyo. The properties are super comfortable, tastefully furnished, fully equipped with all amenities, and they accommodate up to 10 people. So, really, the only thing you'll need to bring with you is your toothbrush and maybe a change of clothes. They come with fast, unlimited wireless internet, dedicated workspaces, and fully equipped kitchens, and they're just a delight to stay in. Fantastic alternative to Japanese business hotels, which, if you've ever stayed in one, you probably know they're tiny, they're noisy. Fine for a night or two if you're on your own, but longer term or with a family, you'll probably feel you're in a jail cell very quickly in a Japanese business hotel. So if you want to give yourself a sense of space and freedom by renting a real home with comfortable Western beds, including all the necessities like baby bedding, children's toys, high chairs, etc., you definitely want to reach out to Tokyo Family Stays. They've been at it for over a decade. They're a fully licensed minpaku or short-term stay operator. And as a special bonus for our viewers and listeners, they're also throwing in a breakfast basket upon arrival for anyone who books and mentions the Japan Real Estate Podcast or NTI. And not only for guests, if you're a property owner, you've got an investment property that you want to tweak for higher profit, or a holiday home that you want to rent out when you're not using it via short-term stays, drop them a line today. See how they can help you maximize your property's income. And again, as a special bonus to our viewers and listeners, they're also offering a free audit of your existing short-term stay listings without any obligation whatsoever. So feel free to reach out to them at tokyofamilystays.com. Well worth a visit. And again, if you're in the market for a family home in or around the Tokyo metropolitan area, Emil's your man. Don't be shy to reach out to him as well at sales@realestate.jp. And now, back to the podcast.
So give us 1 second. Ziv has someone at the door. So when he comes back, I'll continue saying what I have
I
to
had a
say.
suspicion that there was an NHK guy, not a post delivery. We'll see if he comes up, if he dares to come up here. Give me a second. No sign of him.
No,
Probably
so
realized his mistake, and I didn't even have to bring the shotgun out.
great. So, but anyway, just onto the point I was saying, this one particular case I mentioned where it's a monthly mansion, one of the good things is so Tracy has already been managing it as a monthly mansion for almost a decade,
Okay.
right? With her clients. And so I think in the early days when it was Airbnb, that was okay. Then they changed the rules. So they did it as monthly mansion as well. The management company and Body Corp have already had their learning curve and have accepted that. So it's already operating now as a monthly mansion.
Ah, got it.
That's
That's pretty
why,
rare, isn't it?
yeah, there's not many people that are just selling their monthly man the places that are already set up for Airbnb and monthly mansions.
Yeah.
Right. So because it was already operating and already running, Tracy actually came to me and said, look, I've got Emil, I've got a client that wants to sell their property. Can you sell it for them? And so yeah, so that's why we did the process of the sale. We listed it on the databases. I also did a walkthrough on my social media explaining it. And yeah, in a few weeks, I got a within 3 weeks, we had a we sold it basically. The because the person who bought it, he's also knows it's very hard to find a place that's already running, that's already, it's just turnkey, right? He can start getting rent right away without, it's already furnished. He doesn't have to go through all that process. And there's no risk because he's not going to buy it and then learn later on that the body corp is not happy with running it as short term because it's already has that history for a decade. So it just made a lot of sense for him in this case. But that's a very rare situation. So I don't say, please contact me. I'll find you an Airbnb or short-term stay property.
No.
That's not what I do at all. In fact, if you are interested in short-term stays and whatnot, please don't reach out to me. I probably cannot find you a property that will meet those needs. If your budget is, you know, $1 million US and above, I think that's the price point where you can probably find a house in a good location in central Tokyo that can meet some of the zoning requirements. But if you're much below that, it's going to be a house that's really far away in an area where tourists won't really want to stay. Or if it's, you want it to be in a good area, it's going to be in a mansion, like a condominium, and that as well is not going to be suitable for short-term stay.
Mm.
So that's where we're at. A lot of people have the dream, have the idea. It's not so easy to execute. I had 12 Airbnb properties in the peak, and after regulation and COVID, I basically exited all of them, and I have no interest going back in that business.
Yeah, I mean, we kind of make it a point to say we'll help you buy whatever you want to buy, but depending on what you're looking for, it could take a long time to find something, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I know. And again, I think in your business, you accept sort of, you know, a payment up front to do the work for you. In our business, as like a traditional real estate agent, we only get sale commission on the sale of the property. So
I'm running into some agents recently, especially foreign run agencies in Japan that started charging in advance, I guess, because they do get a lot of tire kickers or whatnot. So they charge a fee that's separate from the actual commission that they're going to get on the sale for research and viewings or whatever the case may be. That's become a bit of a thing now with people serving foreigners, at least.
Yeah. And I think those ones, they specialize in that research. And for this kind of niche of property. And I don't do that. There are people that will do that. You want the short-term stay kind of property? Yes, there are companies that specialize in that. That's not what I do. If you want just a run-of-the-mill property in central Tokyo, then that's what I can help.
And agents get paid on settlement, yes. So you could be in the market helping somebody for a good few months and they don't find what they're looking for, or they had a change of heart and you get basically nothing, right?
Yeah. And look, that happens a lot. So there's two types of clients that I deal with mostly, right? One that which we're talking about now, which is the foreign cash investor that just wants to buy a place in Tokyo. They got a bunch of cash. They just want to buy a place. And I think that's a lot of your clientele as well.
Yeah.
Not in Tokyo,
but yeah.
For all around Japan, right? Now, but probably the majority of my clientele are long-term foreign residents, often with a Japanese spouse, or they're both foreign and they have a young family. Or recently, actually, it's been Japanese clients, the actual Japanese citizens, but they don't speak a lot of Japanese. They may be Japanese American or they're mixed. And so their upbringing was all overseas.
Mm.
So English is their main language. They may not read or write a great deal of Japanese, but they are Japanese citizens. So recently I've been getting those inquiries as well and helping clients like that. But largely it's the language barrier issue, but they tend to be long-term, like living in Japan and eligible for financing and eligible for home loans. So that's my strong point, is I'm able to get the financing. I was saying just before we started the call, we just had a guy who bought a 190 million yen property plus 10 million yen of closing costs. So it's actually came to 199.8 million yen was the mortgage that we got for him at 0.44% financing. And he's settling at the end of this month. And that was for a renovated mansion in central Tokyo. So if you're eligible for financing and you live here, then that's most of my clients. And when I do the search, I do a Zoom call, I get all their tax information, I do the home loan application for them on their behalf and get the paperwork going. I don't need to charge an upfront fee, right? I've already met them. I've discussed with them. I've spent several hours with them already.
And you pre-qualify them for a loan, which is a big one.
Yeah, and they're pre-qualified. So if there's a scenario where they don't go ahead with the purchase and whatnot, I mean, that's just, I guess it can't be helped. Chog and I lose out on that potential commission. But for the most part, I've already done some vetting and due diligence, and we're at a stage where I know they're a realistic buyer. I know they have the financing available, and what they are looking for is realistic. I get sometimes clients who the age, price, and location that they are searching for, their requirements don't exist. If they want a 3-bedroom house in Minato-ku for 80 million yen or 70 million yen, I'm like, it doesn't exist.
And you're not even going to put the time to research into that because you know it's not going to happen,
Yeah. Oh, look, you can jump online and we'll do a quick search. Show me all the houses in Minato-ku. There's not a single one that's under 100 million yen.
Yeah.
But and if sometimes I'll say, look, I want to work with you to find the unicorn. I mean, they don't exist, and I'm not
Get
a unicorn
that
hunter.
out.
I'm not gonna spend my time and then to do that. It's not realistic. If you have realistic goals, and if we see, look, within your requirements, there is 3 to 5 properties that are very close to meeting your needs, and we'll go view them, but they're just not the right one. But they exist, right? They're pretty close. Then it's just a matter of time. When they pop up, we'll keep doing viewings, and then we'll jump on the right one when it pops up, right? And that's generally the approach. And in that case, I'm okay spending the time with them because I do feel that they are generally realistic about their goals and what they're trying to achieve and what they're trying to purchase. But I need to be honest with people when I say, look, I think what you're looking for just doesn't exist in the market. If something does pop up in that price range, there's going to be something significantly flawed with it. Often it could be a very old building, like from the 70s or 80s. It could have severe water leaks or water damage.
It's interesting that we're saying that, sorry, just as a side note in Japan, because if you say that in another country, very old is not 70s and 80s, right?
Oh, precisely, yeah. But for Japanese terms, yeah, 70s or 80s house, insulation is terrible, water leaks, just the general condition of the property. And for Akiya and these other regional properties, yep, that's great. It's good. It's a good value property. But in central Tokyo, when the land is worth 100 million yen, you're not trying to save that much on the. You want a quality building as well. Or it could be no rebuild allowed, a no rebuild allowed property. Or something else awkward. Maybe the bedrooms are only 3.5 jaw in size. The LDK is weird. It's something strange with it. So it won't. Even though the size and the price and the location may be okay, the actual property when you go in is just terrible. It's not suitable for the person's needs. And when someone's unrealistic about their expectations, that's what's going to happen. And there's no scenario where you can achieve your goal.
Yeah, with we get a bit of that too. So there's two types. There's the unicorn hunters, in which case we say, sure, if anything like that ever crosses our desk, we'll send it your way, but it's not likely to happen. But there's the other type, like people who are looking for a house within a reasonable budget in a location that just doesn't have that many listings on a regular basis. That probably doesn't happen much in Tokyo, but we've got, for example, people who want to buy in Miyoko or near some of the ski fields or onsen spots in a tiny little hamlet that, there are only going to be like five listings a year that show up there, right? So that we will sit on and we will, continue to do active research until we happen to find one and then we jump on it. But that's not because they're unreasonable. It's just because that area doesn't have that much activity going on there, right?
Yeah. Well, Ziv, weren't we on a Zoom call with a client looking near a ski field, and they said
Yeah,
they want to
exactly. Like that guy, exactly.
within and like I mean they said
Between this
they want to
slope and
land
that slope, yeah.
between these two slopes, and basically within a they wanted ski in, ski out
Yeah.
of a certain slope, and there's well literally like 10 plots of land that exist within that region, within that range.
So
So
yeah, we can wait until one of those 10 comes up for sale.
And yeah, so unless you go and knock on their door and say, look, I got the cash to go and just buy them out directly. And even then, you need to combine two lots of land. No one lot of land suits your needs. It's like, okay, that's a different level of project that usually I don't get onto.
We can't. I mean, we as well, because we pride ourselves on being able to serve you anywhere in Japan, but that means that we are not physically present everywhere in Japan. So the best that we can do is contact the local agencies and try to get on their good side and hope that they'll send listings to us before they publish them online. But chances of that are usually pretty slim.
Now, here's some big news for anyone interested in Akiya, the abandoned vacant homes that are abundant all around Japan for very attractive purchase prices. Akiya Mart, our latest sponsor, is a recently founded online search and discovery tool for Japanese real estate. Its user interface will be very familiar to users of Zillow or Redfin. The platform essentially scouts the internet for property listings, translates them into English, and displays prices in US dollars, all in one place and with a dynamic map interface that makes browsing, finding, and shortlisting your favorite properties a piece of cake. Which any of you have been struggling with the dozens, if not hundreds, of Japanese property websites that are available online and their very clunky interface will probably find a real blessing. They've got already over 500,000 listings on the platform, and the database is expanding daily, ranging from abandoned rural homes to luxury urban properties. Akiya Mart makes it easy to find your dream home in Japan, regardless of your budget. Now, while the platform is essentially free for use, here's an exclusive offer for listeners of the podcast. You can use the promo code NTI to receive $5 off Akiya Mart Pro. The subscription will unlock a bunch of very attractive features for you, including unrestricted access to the entire nationwide property database and a whole range of filters, which will help power charge your search for that elusive perfect home and make it even easier. So hop over to akiya-mart.com. That's AKIYA-MART, akiya-mart.com, and kick off your search today.
I mentioned this Azabu house that we found for like 200 million yen, 210 mil. That is a unicorn. And like for that area, to find a house that's made of concrete, three-story house that's made of concrete, is one, that's hard to find. Two, in an area that is zoned to, like, permissible for short-term stay in hotels in Minato-ku near Azabu-Juban, is very rare. And to be honest, that 200 million yen price point, I feel, is really affordable, and good value for what that is. So I'm trying to tell my guy, my client, that this is the unicorn, right? And so for a lot of people, 200 million yen or 1.5 million US doesn't feel like unicorn, the unicorn feel, but it is. When you're in, like, finding a place that can be used for short-term stay, essentially it's a hotel in a great location that meets so many requirements.
We just don't. I mean, Tracy can testify to that. I remember her sharing with us how long it takes her to find a new property that she can then list, right?
Yeah, and then it's about 6 months to get it got like the one that so I've been working with an owner. They've per he purchased and then it took 6 months to get it licensed, furnished, and open, and it's just opened. So, and it's doing really well, but we were ready, right? So, you've got to have all your ducks in a row. You really do.
For management too, I mean, even after the purchase, I guess, Tracy, you're unique in that you're very proactive, like we've seen, and you're gonna get into that in this summit as well, like the tools that you use to constantly stay on your toes and see what the competition is doing. But I'm sorry to say this, I'm trying not to generalize, but most of the Japanese property management companies don't take those extra steps. They'll advertise and wait for people to hit them up, and if not, they just chuck it down to a low season or what, right? I mean, that's been our experience at least. There's not many, same as Emil is like proactive and very much on the buyer side, and most Japanese agents are not. They're just like there to facilitate the transaction, and they're not gonna strategize with you, or like you guys are unique in that you're proactive in what you do, right?
Try to be. Do my best.
Yeah. But that's also why it's easy for me to, when I have my clients, I'm like, hey, yeah, work with Tracy, like this guy for the Azabu house. I'm like, yeah, Tracy, I'm gonna get you to go have a look at it and set it up, and you're the person
I've got this thing recently where people actually pay me for the consultation, and then when I give them the consultation, they're like, I hear you, but I'm gonna buy this bucket of crap anyway because I really fell in love with it. Like, it's not even that they don't like. You paid me to tell you that it's a bucket of crap. So why are you doing that?
Yeah. Oh, look, I like those kind of clients. And I feel comfortable with clients that have done their due diligence. And I have a version of this with my clients, right? Where, we'll go view some properties. And often when it's a very first viewing, I've just done a Zoom call with them, I've gotten their tax documents, discussed with the bank, gotten some tacit numbers about how much they can borrow. Then we'll go and do a first viewing. And we'll view, usually 2 to 5 properties on the first viewing. Sometimes they love this first or second one that they see. But even then, I'll say, look, let's view about 5 to 10 properties. You may go back and still think the first one is the right one, but you don't know until you've seen about 10. So do the due diligence, understand what the pros and cons are for all of them, and then you can be confident that the very first one you saw is the right one.
But in Tokyo, won't that be gone by the time they view 10 properties? Because I know when people do contact us to purchase in Tokyo, which is not that much, a lot of the time, by the time we even get to the agent to schedule a viewing, they're like, oh, sorry, just got an offer yesterday.
Yes and no. So it's like we can probably do that in, like, just say the first weekend we look at 4 to 5 properties. And if they think it's really the right one, and also I feel, look, this is actually a great property, because I see so many every weekend, right? So sometimes I'll tell the client, look, don't fall in love with this one just because it's got an oven. I know you think it's the right one, but trust me, this is dime a dozen. Right, so it's great, but it's not the be all and end all. Let's keep looking for more. But sometimes, if I agree with them that actually, yeah, look, this is really special, this is really fantastic, like this one I just mentioned before, that was 190 million yen that we just settled on. That was the second property that they saw of 7 in the day. So looked at 7 for that day. It was a second one. And I said, look, yeah, I agree, this is a great property. And they loved it. And then we kept going throughout the whole day. And at the end of the day, we actually went back and we looked at it again. And they slept on it and they said, look, yeah, it is a great one. And I agreed with them. Yeah, I think it's definitely a great one. But we looked at 7 in that day, and the third through the seventh were just nothing compared to the first one. And so that's why they went back for it. And I think they were comfortable as well that the 7 that they had looked at for that day, this was definitely the best. And I was also comfortable and confident telling them it is fantastic. But yeah, often if it has only been 3 or 4, I will schedule, look, let's do another viewing soon of both the property that you loved and another 3 or 4 properties in the area. We'll pull up some more just so you can be certain. Right. So if it really is a great one, we'll try to do it within a week. We'll try to get those other ones done. And that takes enough time to get the paperwork done as well for the bank and get some approvals in place. And we'll also talk with the seller and tell them we want to do a second viewing. We liked it so much, we want to do a second viewing. There are cases where people drag their feet and I tell them, look, this is fantastic. You don't understand. Like, this is really great.
It's not going to be here much longer, right?
And yeah, and because it was their second one, the first or second, they think all of them are going to be like that. And then we get to number 10 or 20 that we viewed, and you're like, yeah, the first one was clearly the best, and it's a shame it's gone. We dragged our feet. So I get some people, I have to tell them, slow down. Let's look at some more before you make the decision. Because I know from my experience, it's not that great. The price location proposition isn't maybe the best one. But then there are other ones where I try to encourage them, look, don't drag your feet. This is a fantastic offering that really meets your needs. And I try to push them along and they dilly-dally and then they lose it and they regret afterwards. So it happens both ways. But I reckon 5 to 15 properties, once you've looked about that many, you should be confident when you find the right one.
And you'll feel it in your bones. That's what I always do that when I'm looking at properties as well. It's like, you know, you You need to look at them all, and then you get to just you need to picture yourself in there. What I do is I picture the guests in there, and I picture, is this a good way of is it a good flow of the building, and how can I make this work? And it's the same thing if you have to live there. Can you see yourself living in there?
Definitely. And that's why, yeah, the first, I tell people, look, the very first property you see, it's like you don't want to decide on that. You don't want to marry your first girlfriend or boyfriend.
Don't get emotionally attached. That's what I keep saying, and I occasionally catch some flack for that. But yeah, I will keep saying that because I think it's important.
You may go back to marry her later on,
Yeah.
but you don't want to. The first girl that kisses you on the cheek, you're like, this is real love, and that's it. And then have a few more, and maybe the love is still there at the end, but that's my analogy
On
for
that
it.
happy note, I will have to jump out. I've got a call coming soon. My apologies.
Sorry for jumping out earlier. I had an issue with I had to, one of my air conditioners is broken, and it needs to be fixed. So yeah,
All
we'll get
right. Thanks
coordinating all
for
that
listening, and we shall see you all again soon in person.
in person. Exactly. So
All right. Thank you.
Thanks, guys.
bye.
So there you have it. A whole lot of information packed into that conversation. I hope you enjoyed it as much as we did. Let us know what you thought. And of course, if you have any questions that you want answered on the podcast or any topics that you'd like discussed, we would love to hear from you. Feel free to send in your questions or suggestions. Our contacts are all in this and other episode show notes, as is the Buy Me a Coffee link. If you want to show your financial appreciation, let us know what you would like us to talk about in coming episodes. We love hearing from you. Now, before we go, we're also, as always, going to tell you and also link to our other sponsor's website. That's Hiroshi Shimizu, immigration lawyer and administrative scrivener. If you're thinking about moving here on a more permanent basis, or you're already in Japan on some sort of a temporary visa, and you want to switch to a longer term or permanent one, or if you're considering setting up a local company or a branch office of a foreign company, and you've got any sort of business or visa-related inquiries, or even if you just want to find out what your options are on any of these topics, feel free to contact Hiroshi Shimizu. You can find him at japanimmigrationexperts.com, and he can help you set up a company, apply for any kind of visa, or just provide you with the best advice and extremely affordable consultation related to these topics. And he's already done that for many of our listeners. So feel free to reach out to him. Again, that's japanimmigrationexperts.com, and you'll be well on your way. And that's it from us for today, folks. Hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Japan Real Estate Podcast. Do share it with your networks, and please let us know what you think. So leave us a short rating or review on the iTunes Store, on Spotify, or just drop us a line in the comment section of wherever you might have found this episode. We love hearing from you. Hope to have you with us again next time. And until then, have a great day or night ahead. Yoroshiku.